Hi, welcome to the call. Welcome, everyone. This is Steve Prusak, facilitator of the World Peace Diet Mastery Program, facilitator training, and World Peace Diet Circle. Welcome. Thanks for joining us on today's call. Dr. Will Tuttle will be joined by special guest Keith McHenry coming up in just a minute here. Just some quick announcements. Your membership site is updated with your January resources, so just go ahead and log in and you can download there. Now, I've received some feedback that some people are having a hard time accessing some information in the membership site or on the calls, so just feel free to drop me an email at steve@prusak.com. That's steve@prusak.com. If you're having any technical difficulties or anything I can help you with, or even if you want me to give you a call back, I can walk you through things, and I can resend your emails with the login, password, access information without any problem at all. So there's no way we're going to let you be shut out of this program or anything because of the technology. I'll help you through anything that needs to be helped with. So please, please communicate with me, and I will be in touch. I know one person was emailing me, and I hope she was resolved. I don't know if she's on the call tonight. Oh, it looks like she is. So that person knows she's in California, and I was helping her. I sent her another login information, so hopefully that worked for you. And if it didn't, again, send me another email, and I'll be on that. So let's welcome to the call right now our host, Dr. Will Tuttle.
Great. Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate everything you're doing to keep everyone connected here in the world of cyberspace with veganism and compassion for all life and feeding the hungry and feeding the world and sustaining our beautiful earth through thick and thin here, which is really quite a huge job. And I also want to just remind everyone that Steve has been organizing Raw Palooza, which is really a gigantic effort, and he's bringing together lots of vegan raw experts. Some of them, really the top people in the world, are involved in this online program that's going to be starting on January 23rd. It's totally free. If you'd like to partake of some of it or all of it, there is an option to get the VIP membership where you get all the recordings and everything and transcripts and all kinds of stuff. But he's been, this is his brainchild, heart child, and I think a lot of wonderful ripples are radiating out into the world already. He's had some preview events, and we'll have done lots more events once the 23rd starts, goes for a whole week. So thank you, Steve, for taking time out of your extremely busy schedule right now as you're organizing all that. And I'd like to welcome everyone to the call. Thank you all for joining us this evening. This is our third Thursday of the month call for the World Peace Diet Circle. We have a fantastic, heroic person joining us tonight, Keith McHenry, one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs. And you all know the drill, I think, if you've been on the call a few times before. If you have any questions for me or for Keith as we're going along, press *2 on your phone, and that'll show up here. We'll be able to see that you're raising your hand. Or if you're at your computer, go ahead and type it in, and I'll try to keep an eye on that as well, any questions that are coming. All right, so this is a chance for you to ask questions and or make comments, and that's part of the beauty of this whole thing is that it's interactive. And so I'd like to, before I go ahead and introduce our special guest for this evening, Keith McHenry, let's just take a minute and just feel our connection for a moment with each other and with this beautiful planet Earth that we are on, and with the, however you conceive of the infinite source of all life. And give thanks for this precious opportunity that we have for a human life, that we are part of an awakening of human consciousness on this planet now, and a key component of that is our treatment of each other, of animals, of future generations, of ecosystems, and that we are awakening from this obsolete cultural hypnotic trance of violence towards other living beings, towards those who are vulnerable, and learning to create a new world with structures, social structures, and behaviors that reflect the essential compassion and wisdom that are always shining in our hearts as manifestations of a loving universal presence. So thank you all so much for joining us, and let's just know that we are joined on this call not only with the people who are physically here, but there will be a lot of people who will be listening to it in the days and weeks to come, because it's all recorded, and also that there are many other people who maybe aren't actually listening, but they're part of this movement to build a more compassionate and free world. And nothing, I think, more important for us to be involved with than this kind of an effort. So I would like to thank all of you for joining us, and then thank Keith McHenry for taking time out of his busy schedule to be with us. And I don't know if you've been in jail lately, Keith. Very often the people who are doing the most important best work are people who find themselves behind bars in a repressive society. Keith's been in jail over 100 times over the last 30 years because he's insisted that it is a good thing to feed vegan food to hungry people. So I just want to introduce Keith to say a few words here before we unmute his phone. He's an author of a couple of wonderful books. I have this new book, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. So Keith is one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs back in 1980 in Massachusetts in the Boston area. And he is an author of a couple of books. He's a really fantastic speaker. I've heard him speak several times. And he's also an artist. He does great art you see in his books. And he has recovered, cooked, and shared food with the hungry for over 30 years. As I mentioned, he spent over 500 nights in jail. He has faced life in prison under the California Three Strikes and You're Out law for feeding people food. And has traveled all over the world, speaking at colleges, bookstores, cafes, and sharing free vegan meals with many of the over 1,000 Food Not Bombs groups that are now active around the world. I mean, think of that. In 30 years, Keith has been working so hard, and we now have over 1,000 Food Not Bombs groups. These are all autonomous groups. We've seen them in action. It's just a fantastic thing. I remember when we were in Fort Myers a few years ago, and we were staying at the Unity Church, and I was giving lectures and workshops there, and there were these young kids from the community. They were just still in high school, or maybe, you know, just in their early 20s, and they were just collecting food from local grocery stores that was over the hill. It was organic, it was vegan, and they were in the kitchen of the church, and it was such a beautiful sight to see all these young people laughing and working together and creating all this healthy vegan food and then taking it out to the local park to feed hungry people. And this is something that's going on. So the idea is not just to feed hungry people, but also to create positive social change. I've been really enjoying reading this book. I highly recommend Hungry for Peace. It's a brand new book. It just came out. In fact, it comes out April of 2012, so it's not even out yet. Somehow I've got a copy. So Keith is really one of the living heroes of our time, of our movement. And we're really honored to have you with us, Keith. So I'm just going to go ahead, Steve, I guess, we'll unmute your phone. And we'd love to just hear a little bit from you about Food Not Bombs. So, Keith?
Let's see here. Yes, so Food Not Bombs, one of the things, we were all what we were calling ourselves vegetarian in 1980.
Right.
And one of the things we wanted to do was to try to introduce people to plant-based diet. And in reality, you know, in the years since, we're now vegan. But at the time, we just had no animals in our food, and we were really excited to share that. And we thought, wow, how are we going to, you know, we can describe the beautiful things about, you know, vegan diet, but maybe if we gave people free samples of this wonderful food, they'd be convinced that it wasn't something so odd or weird. And if you think back to 1980, a lot of America assumed that essentially this was Indian food or something like that. They didn't realize that it was actually a diet that could really change the world. And so we wanted to, both through our literature at our table, but really through the experiential event of them just passing by our table and us inviting them to share our food and then engaging them in conversation about a whole host of ideas around exploitation, nonviolence, and all of that, tried to, gently encourage people to become vegetarian. And the impact was really quite amazing at the beginning because it was such an unusual thing. There may be, you heard of some hippies being vegetarian, and you heard of people in India being vegetarian, but people then just walking around Boston really had never been introduced to such a thing at that time. So that was our original, idea of giving out the food. The other thing was that Ronald Reagan had just been elected, and we were a bit concerned that he would, do what he was suggesting, which was cut out education and health care and other social services and direct the money towards the war with the Soviet Union. And so we want to, also express that we could, live in a world of peace, that we could put our resources into things like health care and education, nutrition, and things like that, and that ultimately that would be real security for the people of the United States, much more security than aiming thousands of nuclear weapons towards the people in the Soviet Union while they were aiming thousands of nuclear weapons towards our community. And so it's a way of kind of tying both the global peace and economic policies with your own personal life of making the choice of to be vegan. And so that's that was our initial idea. The eight of us were all vegan at the time, and so we were naturally assumed that that would be a good idea. And we also, of course, in our education to become vegan, we had read books like Francis Moore LePage's Diet for a Small Planet, and we thought, if we're going to end hunger, really need to be walking our talk. And so we thought that would be to show that working to end world hunger also included, working to end the meat industry and to basically encourage a plant-based diet.
Right, because I guess obviously, there's such a major connection, the fact that we're feeding most of the grain that we're growing to animals while people are starving is really unconscionable. It's always been unconscionable, but especially now when we really realize that we could easily feed everyone, and yet when people are eating meat and dairy products, it's in many ways direct theft from people who are going hungry. And I guess you can really make that point when you're in the literature that you're making available to people. And also, I guess you probably found out that it was better to serve plant-based foods because they were less dangerous if they got warm in the hot sun, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was also another concern of ours, is we wanted this to be a model. We figured that, it's sort of like Jesus's idea of, teaching people to fish rather than to just give them a fish, in that parable. Which, of course, is kind of it should have been like give them barley or teach them to grow barley. It would have been more appropriate. But the idea was if we wanted people that were low income to reproduce this idea and to do it, you know, safely, it made a lot more sense to have a plant-based diet, because then you could safe, you know, it's a combination of things. We're recovering food that can't be sold. We were concerned about the huge amount of waste. I was a produce worker, and I just was amazed at how much food I was discarding, because it was less than perfect and the customers wouldn't buy it. And so we thought, well, we should do something about that, address the issue of food waste. It just seemed outrageous. There was all this food waste while people were hungry. And so since it didn't make sense to recover, you know, wasted meat, because then that would be too, you know, difficult to, you know, organize steam tables and refrigeration and all the different resources that one would need
right.
to make that safely happen. So that also contributed to our idea that the food should be plant-based. And then the other thing is that you could, you can really tell when plant-based foods are not safe to eat. They, you know, there are some exceptions, but largely it just tastes and looks horrible, so you wouldn't really want to eat it. Whereas meat, could actually be grilled and just taste fantastic, and you would end up dropping dead immediately just from being, you know, having spoiled meat. And so, you know, this made it so that any young person, any college student, any, like we were at the time, could actually reproduce this project without having to raise a lot of money, that it would just be something that anyone could really do. And then the other thing is that that we wanted to express our sense of nonviolence, because we were, you know, as the name says, it's food, not bombs. But we didn't really want to be, like, killing animals and the whole violence of that, and then handing out this, you know, animals that had suffered. At the same time, we're somehow saying that we shouldn't be having
right.
wars. So we wanted to really have an impact on the community from that point of view. So those all worked really, really well together. And then, of course, with the genetically engineered foods, which are now sadly at the core of the industrial meat production system, you know, it even gives us even yet another reason why it's important to have plant-based diets. So,
right, and to have organic in many cases too. I think you try to get organically grown foods, aren't you, for the most part, if you can?
Yeah, that has definitely been. In fact, in very rare cases do we have to take inorganic food from commercial stores, because there is 40% of the food that's produced in the United States is discarded before it gets to the table. And
oh my gosh!
So everyone,
I just want everybody to hear that. I mean, that's amazing. 40% of the food that's produced in the United States is discarded before it even gets to the table. Isn't that just astonishing?
Yeah,
wow.
it's really incredible. So there's clearly enough
then after
food.
Then after it gets to the table, too, right? I mean, yeah, after it gets to the table, a lot of people throw away a lot of that, even after it gets to the table. So,
yeah, there's a possibility if you added up all the stuff that ended up like in, you know, on people's plates that aren't eaten and thrown away. It could be roughly half of all the food that is grown
yeah.
in the United States and produced is discarded, but 40% is already really crazy when you consider that half of the people in the United States are struggling to survive, and, of course, the number one thing people have to do is to eat, and many people are making choices between eating and medical care or rent and housing. And then, sadly, because of the extreme poverty, I've noticed driving around, you know, on my speaking tours that I will see billboards where McDonald's is actually advertising that one of the great things about them is that they have the 99-cent Whopper or whatever it is, and that they even advertise to the homeless, basically, that here you have no money, why don't you come in with the dollar you've gotten from, you know, panhandling and buy our hamburger, and which, you know, is really outrageous since, you know, on top of living on the streets, you end up getting to be ill eating this food that is subsidized by the taxpayers of the United States. We pay over $30 billion a year to finance the meat and industry in the United States. And that would be the farm subsidies that we see in the Department of Agriculture. And the sad thing about that is that even those subsidies that go to corn or to soy are going to corn and soy that are often genetically modified and are actually grown for the purpose of feeding poultry, cattle, and other livestock. And so that's why a Burger King or McDonald's meal is so inexpensive, because everyone, including all the vegans in the United States, are funding the meat industry with their tax dollars. And that directly links to the concept that also inspired the name Food Not Bombs, which was we were seeing that 50 cents of every federal tax dollar, and now that's a bit higher now, was going to the military. So if you start to take the other 50 cents of every tax dollar and look into that, you have, you know, billions going to subsidize, farming for Monsanto and Cargill and the large transnational corporations that are involved in the meat industry. And then you have another $80 billion or so, which the U.S. taxpayers are paying to promote the actual running of KFC, McDonald's, Burger King in other countries as an effort to promote U.S. Culture to the world around us. So you start to look into even the non-military portion of the of our taxes.
Right.
Sadly, so much of it is just redirected towards really terrible projects. And at the same time, you know, we're facing cuts in healthcare. We're facing cuts in education. The education cuts are just really incredible. And then there's all these fantastic programs that could happen that we don't even entertain, like organic meals for school lunches. You know, we hear about that a little bit from Michelle Obama, but we just don't put really the funding into that kind of thing because, you know, it needs to go to, you know, to military buildup and to, you know, and to genetically engineered crops and things like that. So.
Right. So what you're doing essentially is besides feeding people organic vegan food by the millions, really. I mean, you figure you've got thousands you've got a thousand different groups around the world, and it just goes on. But it's also really about a conversation to help us ask, why is this happening? Why are there all these hungry people? Actually, with all the wealth that we have, are we not able to provide the bare minimum of food for people? And I think that's really
That's so important to the. There are a couple of different things that we wanted to do. It was sort of by accident. Our first meal, we did baked goods and had kind of food theater for the first year. But in March 26th of 81, we decided we would dress up as hobos and share food in front of the stockholders meeting of the Bank of Boston to say that their policies could lead to economic crisis. And we had seen some, homeless people eating with us, but we were really amazed when the night before we decided to talk to these men at the Pine Street Inn, a local shelter in Boston, and tell them about this protest. And we actually approached it from the point of view not that it was a meal, but that it was that we wanted them to join in expressing their opinion about these unwise investments in nuclear war and nuclear power. And so they, about 70 people showed up. And the other thing that had happened, we were in a downtown, across from the Federal Reserve Bank, outside the Federal Reserve Bank where this meeting was being held. And all these business people arrived. They had never seen food out on the streets like this because, the last time that was happening was the Great Depression. So there became this conversation between the homeless and the business community on the streets of Boston outside of this bank. And we go, wow, this is just an incredible idea. It so encourages dialogue about all these ideas. And so that gave us the the encouragement that we should try to do this wherever there is a diversity of people walking by, so that we can have homeless people and not homeless people all hang out together and discuss these ideas, learn from each other, and put a human face on a crisis that normally people try to ignore and just walk by. I mean, that's happening less now since it's affecting so many people personally because of the downturn in the economy. But at the time, you know, for many, for the first couple of decades of doing this, that was such a transformative event. And that then everyone would ask, well, what is it we're eating? Because they would like it. They go, this is very nice. I want this recipe to make it myself. And then they would be shocked to find out that it was a vegan meal and that really wasn't tuna fish sandwich that they were eating, but it was tofu with seaweed or something like that. And that would just totally jar their minds yet again into thinking even more outside the box. So we've seen a couple of incredible things about the conversations that happen at the meal. In one of them, we started a program called Food Not Lawns, where we were discussing the transportation of grass being shipped from Eugene area, from the Willamette Valley, towards Los Angeles and Phoenix. And we're like, wow, there's all these hungry people, but we're, instead of shipping food, we're shipping grass. And that came up with the idea of Food Not Lawns, which has now become a global movement where we teach people permaculture and organic gardening. And another...
Right, people have their own gardens, and that's a great way for them to feed themselves, is to have their own garden.
Oh, absolutely.
Garden, right? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and the young, we try to get the young kids involved particularly because they don't often know where the food is, and what appreciation do they have when they grow their own vegetables and they get to really play a part in producing food for themselves. And also often we clean up an old vacant lot that's full of glass and tires and things. So suddenly an area of our community is beautiful, just even on that level. And then we detoxify the soil with things like sunflowers and so on. And then the next thing you know, we've got beautiful vegetables in what had been a dirty vacant lot in some community. Another one was the when the banking crisis happened in Iceland, the young kids doing Food Not Bombs came every Saturday to the town square in downtown Reykjavik, and people got to reading the flyers and talking to them. And in one day, the people said, "Wow, we should march to the Parliament building and express our dissatisfaction that the president of the country is also the president of the National Bank, and that he somehow made some very bad decisions, which have now bankrupt our formerly very wealthy country." And that meal grew and grew, and then from the meal, the marches to Parliament, eventually the president resigned, and a new experiment in democracy was born. We have three principles. One is the food is always vegan or vegetarian. And when we say vegetarian, that's because sometimes we do not know what some of our breads, we're not 100% sure what is in them, although we know that there's no meat. And then that we have no leaders, that the movement is, each group is independent and makes the decisions by a process called consensus. And that is a process that's being used, for instance, at the occupations now all over the world. And also that we're dedicated to nonviolence. And so that consensus component was attractive to the people in Iceland, and they started to use that as a way of trying to arrive at a new constitution and a new system where it's focused on the well-being of the local people and not on the profitability of financial investments. So.
Wow, so you had a say in that, and what happened in Iceland, it sounds like, because that was an incredible transformation. Iceland went from being completely devastated financially to actually letting the banks fail, taking back their power, just doing the opposite of what happened here in this country, and actually getting the government back in the hands of the people again. It's really wonderful.
Yeah.
It's totally downplayed by the media in this country. I think the media didn't want anyone to know what happened in Iceland.
Oh, absolutely not. Not
totally
that, yeah, they
thing.
Voted to give. They, what was amazing is you have artists and musicians, and they have gone back to this idea of having amateur politicians, citizen politicians, and they've had meetings where 950 people arrived to discuss how they would involve everyone in Iceland in making the decisions of their constitution. It's incredible, and I happened to be fortunate enough to go there and happened to be there at the time of when it first started, and I was so moved that Funabombs played such a key role in fundamentally changing society in Iceland. And I've been also to other parts of the world where this was similar things were happening. Funabombs was involved in changing the society in the Ukraine and provided meals at what became the Orange Revolution and shared food for 100 days in front of the Parliament building in Kiev. And another insane thing that never made the media was that for 8 months, Food Not Bombs provided the meals in after Katrina in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And the Red Cross gave out our toll-free number, 1-800-884-1136, to anyone seeking food. And they had an arrangement with FEMA and the federal government that they would not go into the area. So instead, they provided people with our phone number and directed them to us. Well, for 8 months, the survivors of Katrina lived totally on a vegan diet. And, of course, in a catastrophe like Katrina, what would make more sense? You have no electricity, no refrigeration.
Right.
Why would you, by the time milk arrived in New Orleans, it would have been, you know, totally, rotten. So the only way you could have fed the people of New Orleans without electricity in that heat for that many months was if it was a vegan diet. And, there's pretty much almost no news about Funabombs' role in being responsible for the largest food relief effort in American history, and that largest food relief effort was vegan.
Wow, that's so wonderful. You know, I just want to encourage everyone to get a copy of this book, Hungry for Peace, by Keith. It just came out because I was just reading it, and the book really goes into the efforts that you've made in Africa, and Asia, Australia, and South America, all over Europe, and it's really a global movement. It started just in Boston, and then went, I guess, to San Francisco, and met a lot of resistance from the police because it was not just feeding hungry people; there was a political dimension to it, and really matured there, and then spread globally. And one of the things you emphasize in the book is that the more the police and the government and the corporations and the military tried to repress Food Not Bombs, it seemed like that the more it would grow faster. The greater the repression, the faster it would grow. And we're seeing the same thing, I think, with the Occupy movement. Somebody just typed in a question, Keith. Are you involved with the Occupy movement?
Oh, yes. This is very interesting. Very active. In fact, in 2003, I attended a meeting in Mexico where we talked about altering the strategy of our protests against the global capital, and we decided that we would promote the idea of organizing occupations outside of symbols of economic exploitation. And so I published a website in 2003 advocating this strategy, and we had already done an occupation in San Francisco in 1989 that was actually organized by the homeless, and we provided the food, and so we had seen how effective that action had been. So we were already organizing, we had tried to do a couple of occupations in the last 2 years or 3 years and had very little participation by the public. But we kept on. And then we actually joined with a larger group of people in May to organize an occupation outside the White House in Washington, D.C. to start on the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. And so we, from that, it turned out we were also being arrested in Orlando, Florida at that time for sharing food. They had made laws throughout the state of Florida limiting the number of meals per year you could share with the hungry. And so during that struggle, we received an email from Adbusters. We worked with Adbusters now for probably since their beginning. We do a program called Bug Nothing Day, where we give out free vegan burgers outside of commercial, you know, shopping places on the day after Thanksgiving. And so we then started promoting Occupy Wall Street immediately in July once we got that first email. Put that on our website, you know, next to the announcement of the occupation in D.C. And then we were Food Not Bombs activists were actually at the core of the original General Assembly in New York City in the weeks building up to the occupation. And then that's partially why you will see that the consensus is used at the General Assembly's. Food thing became really crazy. I actually raised $500 from activists to buy bulk rice and beans through United Natural Foods and Oats. And I started to, my book, I uploaded my book in September to the publishing company's, you know, however they printed it, whatever it was I was doing. Anyway, I just finished it in time to leave to head towards Wall Street, and the calls that I started getting were amazing. So in the end, I ended up sleeping at 15 occupations from mid-September to into December. And all my personal pots and pans, my big 60-quart stainless steel pots and all that, I left in Washington, D.C. because I set up that kitchen. I helped organize a kitchen in Chicago. I went immediately to Wall Street after I spent 3 days at Occupy Chicago and helped with organizing the kitchen there. And all during that time, I was receiving phone calls from occupations asking for, you know, logistical help and suggestions on how to feed all these people for so long and you know, outside like this. And I ended up making a web page during the first week of the occupation to explain how, what supplies you would need, how you would organize the kitchens and all the materials that you would need to successfully have an occupation, because that became obvious. I started, instead of explaining it every few minutes, I could just say, oh, wow, just go to the website. It's over there. And if you have any questions, call me back. So, and yep, I received calls from Middle America, like people from rural Texas and from all these places wanting to know how they could help. I felt like it was such a magical experience to be in touch with so many Americans that wanted to help in any way possible, and that they chose to call Food Not Bombs to plug into the occupation movement was really inspiring.
Wow, thanks for explaining all that. I wasn't aware that Food Not Bombs was so intimately involved with the Occupy movement from the very beginning and helped to really not only feed everybody, but to actually put in the a lot of the philosophy and to keep it on track. That's really great, 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 great thing. I want to just, you know, everybody I think who's on the call are pretty much are all vegans, and they're people who are interested in promoting veganism into the community like you're doing. I mean, you're doing such a great job just directly with that. Can you say a little bit about what a typical person can do, you know, someone living somewhere, wherever, in Massachusetts or in California or in Ohio, how they can plug in, if they were interested in plugging into what you're doing, what would they do?
Well, we have a website, foodnotbombs.net. And at foodnotbombs.net, they were definitely a do-it-yourself DIY type of movement. That's something that's always been fundamental in our philosophy. So the principal thing is to locate the local chapter, which you can find. There's links to all contacts. If for whatever reason you're having trouble finding the local chapter, then you can call me or email me, and that contact information is on the bottom of the front page, and it's also on the all contacts page. And the other thing is that if there is not a chapter already happening in your community, it's very easy to start a chapter. We have a page called 7 Steps to Starting the Food Not Bombs. We also have a startup kit that one can get. That includes the book, Hungry for Peace. And even just the book itself, Hungry for Peace, is really helpful on starting a local chapter. And so one of our ideas, we also have connections with, with many animal rights and vegan organizations. And so one of the things that we try to really do not only is hand out the vegan food on the streets to show people how wonderful it is, but we have, literature from Vegan Outreach and from Farm and Farm Sanctuary, yeah, and all these organizations. So when you pass by the table and you're eating the food, we can direct you to, more information,
right,
on how to get involved. And we also take food to many protests. I just received an email from Istanbul, where Food Not Bombs is providing food in an anti-fur protest there. And so we often are involved in helping organize actions and educational events, conferences, and so on. So basically just go to foodnotbombs.net. And if you need any direct help, I'm happy to do that. And also I speak on college campuses and at bookstores and conferences, and I'll be touring the western part of the United States starting about mid-February and going to about mid-May, at which point I spend the second half of May in Chicago. And then I'm back to Taos with just the one trip so far to the National Animal Rights Conference in Washington, D.C. But Food Not Bombs is starting a school to teach organic gardening and to teach skills on how to organize and fundamentals of working for change. And so that we will be starting to organize that in June and July and August of this summer in Taos, New Mexico.
Great. And Taos. And can people find out about that through, I guess they could send you an email or find out on the website?
I don't have a detailed amount of that yet on the website, but we're just about to do that. And,
right,
we have we have land already to grow the food. And, and that's one of the things we're going to do, fruit trees and vegetables. And then, and also things like, building with, safe alternative building methods, all kinds of different things, how to make decisions by consensus. I'm working on another book right now on how we make decisions at the General Assemblies, at the occupations, and that will be out in the fall. And then I'm also, we're already gearing up for all kinds of activities in the fall to try to link the occupation movement stronger to the issue of vegan diet, because there has been some conflict in the occupations around that, where we're trying to provide vegan meals and people just have kind of a misconception and send us pizzas and things like that. So, we're trying to encourage the occupation movement. They're well-meaning people. They want to help out, and they've seen what happened in Wisconsin. Of course, with the Wisconsin protest, people from all the world ordered pizzas for the protesters. And being Wisconsin, there was certainly a very cheese-oriented pizza delivery occurring during all that. And you have to, we realize people, that's what they, if you're in Germany or in Japan, that's what you're thinking we want. And so we're trying to work on that also within the occupation movement to teach people that there really is a bunch of reasons why it would be good for occupation to occupy our food, basically, which there is a group of us working on, and to show the, you know, the same as the bailout of the banks, here's the bailout of Monsanto and private ownership of 90% of the food seeds by just one company, Monsanto, which is a total threat to our future. And there's a lot more to GMOs than just the private ownership issue, which is tragic enough, and is one of the leading reasons of global hunger right now, contrary to the what's promoted by Monsanto, but also the dangers of genetically modifying ourselves, and there's growing evidence that cancer is directly caused by activator genes entering our, you know, breaking the cell walls of our bodies if we have viruses, and then and causing brain cancer and other cancers in humans, as well as in the animals that are fed the genetically engineered crops. So we're working
right,
trying to connect those to the occupation movement.
Right, right. Yeah, that's fantastic. Wow, well, listen, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate this. Does anyone have any other questions? Press star 2 if you would like to ask Keith a question directly. Press star 2. I have one other question here. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but what is a good reference for the 40% figure for the percentage of U.S. food that is discarded? Is that something that's pretty easily verified online? Somebody wants to know. That's a very incredible statistic.
Yeah, you can actually Google that. And if you go to foodnotbombs.net, you'll see that we have a link on the front page of flyers. And we have PDFs of two studies that of art news articles about two different studies that talk about that on the foodnotbombs.net/flyers.html. And we actually hand out literature specifically about that because that's so psychotic that would happen. And the one study was from the University of Arizona, and I forget where the other study is, but the United Nations itself has been working on this. They're pretty well, the United Nations is kind of interesting that they're really urging a plant-based diet. We have a flyer on that, the relationship between a plant-based diet and fighting climate change. And all this information is free to print out, and we encourage people to print it out and hand it out so that people know about these ideas. And, that's, like, super important. And was there another question, too? It seemed like you had another question.
Actually, that was the somebody that has their hand up. So let me just go ahead and Tara has a question. Go ahead, Tara.
Hi, Keith and Will. How are you today?
Hi. Great.
I am so grateful for the work you do. You're one of my definite heroes in this world. I'm just thrilled for the work you're doing. And I have a couple of questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome. One of my questions is regarding specifically how to recover food from stores and, how you go about that, or could you direct us to which book where you actually detail all that? I have your Cooking for Peace book, and I think that's addressed somewhat in that book. And
Go ahead.
And my other question...
Yeah, tell me the other question.
Oh, the other question is, you said there was a startup page somewhere on your website that told people how, gave them all the basics of how to organize a feed-in. Is that still up?
Yeah, that's called food. It's on there on the front page of the foodnotbombs.net. It'll say how to start a local food not bombs, and it's also food not bombs. foodnotbombs.net/7.html, and the 7 is for the 7 steps of how to start a food not bomb.
Okay.
And it also on that, it provides a sample agenda of an early meeting. So, for instance, when you first start, it'll give you, if you follow, you can alter the times, of the sample times on the agenda. But if you talk about each of those subjects in the agenda and make a decision about them. That really helps. So the basic idea, though, is we don't actually really dumpster dive, although there's there's been an attempt by the government to claim that that's our main source of food. But the reality is we talk to grocery store owners and ask mm-hmm. or the actual produce workers or the people in the bakery and ask them if there's any food that they can't sell and what would be a good time to come by and pick it up. And Whole Foods is one of our largest supporters, really. Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, local food co-ops. And so, we don't really have any trouble recovering this food. The other place that we do get food, of course, is from bagel shops and bakeries. And there are produce warehouses in each city where all the restaurants and small independent grocery stores buy all of their produce. And you can go there early in the mornings, like even at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock, and that's when they're closing because all the trucks have left to go to the grocery stores, and you just ask for what they're discarding. And you usually can find a couple of organic stalls and just focus on them, and particularly people selling organic, they're super happy to give you whatever food they can't sell. So that's how we do that. And all that can be found. There's also a startup kit. So the startup kit, I forget the price. I think it's something like $70 or so. And it has the book Hungry for Peace. It has mm-hmm. a whole piles of flyers you can reproduce. It has a DVD about Food Not Bombs in Africa, which is 15 minutes. And it's something good to show at a benefit concert or some kind of educational event, and as part of it, show the video to get people all interested in the, you can see what people are doing in Africa. Well, then you know for sure you can do it in your community. And then we have a banner, a sample, like a banner you can take out to your meal with you. And then I do a lot of talking to people on the phone, and also one of the best ways to once you get going or you're hoping to get started, if I come by to your community and give a presentation about how Food Not Bombs works, usually you'll end up with, like a half dozen to a dozen new volunteers that will be eager to support you.
Oh, very good, very good. Thank you so much. I have, also working to eliminate GMOs. That's my other passionate project, and I'm just wondering, would you agree with the statement that if there weren't CAFOs, there would be probably no need for monocropping, and if there was no need for monocropping, there more than likely would be no need for genetically modified organisms, genetically modified.
Well, there actually is. There is no need, no matter what you did, for genetically engineered foods of any kind, because right. they are life threatening, and but the thing is that the people that created the genetically engineered like crops like corn and so on are also the same people that did all the different hormones and stuff for cattle, growth hormone and everything, and it's sadly a system where they have farmers, when they grow, if you want to be a farmer and you're going to grow corn, you typically have to sign a contract with Cargill or one of these large companies, and to get the bank loan, to get the seeds and to get the fuel to drive the tractors and all the stuff, requires you to sell your product to to a feedlot or something like that. So it's all interconnected, and it's all intentionally interconnected, and it's all designed to maximize profits for a small number of people while essentially robbing the nutrition out of the food and out of the soil. And it's a conscious program. So it was very important for the meat industry the meat industry, the people that are organizing that are also the same people organizing the genetically modified crops, and they're also working hand-in-hand with the banks, and they're making it essentially impossible for many farmers, unless you become an independent small-scale farmer, to actually grow organic crops. You know, it's just it's really outrageous. And the monocropping is a total disaster for the earth and for the whole thing is just one interconnecting disaster after another. And again, Monsanto controls right now 90% of all food seeds, and that is such a horrible threat. And we can see that thousands of, I think it's 250,000 farmers have committed suicide in India because they were locked into these contracts with genetically engineered foods, and they lost their sovereignty of their farms, you know, and according to Vandana Shiva and people like that are working in the front lines of the food sovereignty movement.
Yeah. What do you think about the most recent alliance with Blackwater, Monsanto and Blackwater, if that's true?
Well, that alliance is just actually, it is true, but however it's been true for a while, but it became much stronger, and that's why the news stories have started to come out. And, you know, in writing the book, Hungry for Peace, I did a lot of research. I didn't put it all in Hungry for Peace because it became so much, and I'm adding it to another book that I'm working on the history of food not bombs. But, you know, originally Monsanto hired 500 detectives to take samples of crops, and then they would sue you if any pollen had gone into your fields and had contaminated your crops, and they'd sue you for stealing. It's very similar to this SOPA case that's happening with pirated things on the internet. This is another case where Monsanto was able to claim that the farmers were stealing their intellectual property. And so they got wise because it was so many people were forced to use their crops, and it was so widespread that they passed laws by local states to actually have the local Department of Agriculture be the detectives to enforce the laws around, like you're, for instance, you're not allowed to save seeds. That's illegal in the United States. And many countries, India and others. And so they now are using our own government, our own tax dollars against us to enforce something that should never have been allowed to happen at all.
Right. Thanks. We're going to have to kind of wrap this up, Keith. It's so great having you. I think we do have actually one other question. Thanks, Tara, so much. Grace has a question. Go ahead, Grace, if you want to ask a question of Keith before we say goodbye.
Good evening, everybody. First and foremost, I wanted to thank Steve. I was busy at the Eco Dogs and Cats website, and then I had another obligation that took me away from the desk, so I couldn't listen online tonight, but he really did help me a lot. So and so thank you for that. And Will, thank you for bringing this together. And with your friend Keith, I mean, this is such an honor for me to be here now. Keith, I don't know if you remember meeting me and my dog, Miss Maddie Moo Moo, when you gave a presentation at Claremont College in California last year.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I had shared with you the San Diego chapter of the Food Not Bombs. It has an awesome program going on. When I cooked with them and went downtown for the feeding, we did the cooking at the Anarchist Collective, and they had big plans for the large yard and the garden, and like you're talking about growing the food. They did mostly have those donations, although there were a few items that they had actually salvaged, like I guess a dumpster diving technique, and there was even a couple of inexpensive items that somebody had bought. They just wanted the extra little spice, you know, so that the food would be really, really wonderful. And I had an awesome time. It was such a diverse group of people, all ages and ethnicities, and it was just a really wonderful experience to cook together and then to go downtown San Diego and feed. Keith, the question I had for you, if you could share a moment about any kind of like a spirituality or a consciousness raising or any kind of a practice or any kind of thing in that dimension that you maybe personally use. I understand that being vegan and advocating for peace, I mean, all of what you do is just so, so powerful and so empowering. Is there any authors or gurus or anybody that you would suggest that maybe a seeker could find that would...
Well, my influence in spirituality was actually Hopi. And I can't be a Hopi because I'm not a Hopi, but that had a huge impact on my life. And my grandfather actually lived with the Hopi at Old Araibi in the 30s. And so as a youngster, I got to go to the snake dances and the corn dances and everything. And at the end of a snake dance, which is a pretty amazing experience, they hand out food, the dancers, to everybody in the audience, everybody on top of the Pueblo, and it's an incredibly moving experience. And so I kind of come from that, I was very influenced also as a youth by Henry David Thoreau, and that was the first novel I ever read, a large book, was Walden, and on civil disobedience. And then the other main thing that I, two things that I do is you know, personally, because actually I do aqua aerobics every day if possible, and that I find is really meditative. And then I draw and paint, and I'm an artist. So, you know, and I would be a Hopi if I would happen to be a Hopi, but I'm not a Hopi, so I can't be a Hopi. But so that would be, you know, that's kind of where, and then see the thing about Hopi people is they are so in touch with the earth and the environment. And I was fortunate to grow up in national parks, so I lived at the Grand Canyon at that time. But I've lived at Everglades and Big Bend, Texas, Rocky Mountain National Park, stuff like that. So that's my you know, had a huge influence, is just living in the wilderness. And then for people, like, I mean, I'm always influenced by different things as far as reader of books and things, and I'll go through, you know, different phases and so on. And I definitely, some of the things, like, are basic classics, so to speak, you know, like Grapes of Wrath and a lot of Steinbeck and Dickens and things like that, because of relating to the issue of me feeding the people on the streets and just liking the that I read them to inspire myself in the writing of books. And then the other people like Vandana Shiva and Arundhati Roy. A woman who's I really enjoy reading her work is Rebecca Solnit, and coincidentally, she's a good friend of one of my friends, David Solnit. And so the kind of thing of putting, of just social change ideas, Starhawk and some of her books, over the years, I've totally been into them. So, you know, it's just not like one specific thing, but just the idea of trying to transform our current world right now and look to kind of a post-capitalist, post-consumerist, post-war future, and trying to just think outside the box in some kind of way and create a public space where that dialogue can happen, and then also to just investigate, you know, how to influence the the rest of the community to join us, and that's, I think, one of the most beautiful things about the occupations. It's been a way to really connect with such a diverse community of people, I think we really have an opportunity to change things in the next few years in such a dramatic way. And, you know, maybe the end of the world type theory of 2012 is actually the end of the negative aspects of the world that we've had to survive through, and the opening of a totally, you know, liberated future. So.
Right.
Awesome.
Wow.
That is
well, thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks, Grace, for that, your insights and for your question too. Beautiful.
Yeah, and if you go to foodnotbombs.net, you can see my speaking tour, and I'm going to be in Southern California. Right. I don't have Claremont booked yet, but I do have at the Anarchist Cafe in downtown Los Angeles at the Anarchist Library. And I'm starting to get together some other stuff in Southern California. And then, and like I say, I'm going to, the Food Not Bombs archives was donated to the University of Victoria, British Columbia. And I'm hoping to go to the dedication of that sometime in, towards the end of April. So. And then I'll be in Chicago,
wow.
Like I say, the last 2 weeks of May. And, so I'm excited about that. Somehow I'm being given the Noam Chomsky Award in Chicago on May 31st. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what that is, but that's something that somebody is telling me I'm getting.
Wow. Well, Keith, it's really, you know, it's been great. I feel like we've barely even scratched the surface of all that you have to tell us. But it's been really inspiring to hear a little bit about what Food Not Bombs has been able to accomplish and the underlying philosophy, which is really, I think, in alignment with what Gandhi was always teaching as well, Thoreau, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Jesus, and the Buddha, and I think all these spiritual teachers as well as social justice activists are basically doing, I think, what we're all essentially trying to do, which is to live the teaching ourselves and create community and social structures that will help support others through the same thing based on compassion for all life. And Food Not Bombs is only one of two organizations that I talk about in the World Peace Diet. The other one is Supreme Master Community as well, because I think they're also using veganism for positive social change in a very similar way. So I want to encourage everyone to get a copy of Hungry for Peace. I think it's a great book, and to find out more about what Food Not Bombs is doing, and invite Keith, if you can, to speak in your community, set up a local or be part of the local Food Not Bombs chapters if it works for you. And we look forward to our paths crossing again. And thanks so much, Keith, again. It really was fantastic to spend this time with you, and I'm sure our paths will be crossing probably this year somewhere, maybe at the Animal Rights Conference or one of the other events. Yeah, definitely.
For sure.
We have
definitely in July, but hopefully before.
Thank you so much,
Will. That's so cool.
All right, Keith. Take care.
Bye-bye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye. All right. So thanks, Keith. And I'm amazed at how the time flies by here. And we are now about 10 minutes past the hour. So I had talked to a couple of people about possibly sharing with us this evening as well. There is Persephone. I'm not sure if Persephone's still on the call. I'm trying to see here. I don't actually see. I know Tara is. We had talked a little bit. Is there anyone who would, if there's anyone who would really like to ask a question or say something at this point, now that we have a little time, with just ourselves here, now that Keith has gone, it was a great presentation. I would suggest there's a few questions here. The question, how do we access the website to help set up kitchens for Occupy? I would suggest just emailing Keith He's very easy to contact, and he's happy to respond to your emails and help you out. And so his email address, just so you know, it's very simple. It's just keith@foodnotbombs.net. So it's very simple. And there was a question, too, I should maybe address, I think, myself real quick here, and that is sort of a basic one. I'm here living at Living Light, learning about raw food. They don't throw away a thing, which is very good. And then she says, one of my fellow students says her brother has goats and they have extra milk, so they're not taking it away from the baby. What are your thoughts? Thanks. Yeah, that's basically, you know, enslaving goats is a lot of cruelty and violence inevitably is involved because these goats are not going to give milk unless they're impregnated, and they're not impregnated, you know, they're impregnated on the schedule of whoever's owning them. The male babies are sent off to slaughter. The females are also sent off to slaughter. I mean, it's the same thing. It's a rape and kill operation. With enormous violence towards the animals, and it may not be quite as obvious, but the fact is that you're stealing their milk, and we say it's extra, like, but their purpose is their time, their life. They're not living their lives in nature the way they did for millions of years. They're in prison and in jail, and I don't think that's anything anyone would wish on anyone, actually. I mean, that's a punishment. It's probably the worst punishment, one of the worst punishments, and these animals haven't done anything to deserve that. So I think that those are the kinds of questions I would ask people who say that they think that perhaps dairy products or milk from goats isn't harmful. I would recommend, actually, seeing when it comes out, the new video, which is by James and Jenny Levesque, A Peaceable Kingdom, A Journey Home. They focus specifically on the cruelty in goat's milk there. And it's very interesting to see how people who have goats for milk, finally one day they want to see where they have to keep sending the male goats off. Somebody just comes by and picks them up, and they don't think too much about it until one day the fellow thinks, I'm going to go just see where they take. And when they see where they take the little baby goat, they realize they can no longer do that. And they have to get out of it and become vegan. So that's a short answer to that question. And let's see. So at this point we have, we have Persephone on the phone. Thank you, Persephone. I'd love if you have a chance. I don't know if we're too late here. I hope everybody's hanging in okay. That really went long with Keith. But Persephone, we had talked a couple of months ago about her projects in Dayton, Ohio, and the Vegan Challenge. And we just thought it would be so great to hear a little bit about some of the techniques you've been using. So, Persephone?
Yes. Hello.
Glad to have you with us. Yeah.
Hi, yeah. I'm glad to be here. So I know it's late, and I'm going to keep it pretty brief and just give kind of an overview of what I do. So for anybody who's interested, I'm just going to share a little bit about what the Vegan Challenge is and what I do. And I've done it 3 years in a row so far, and I'm getting ready to start planning our fourth one. You can go to, first of all, I want to give you the website, and it is theveganchallenge.webs.com, and I'll post this in the forums for people, too, so people can go to that and have that information. And so you can look, look at everything there. You can kind of go back on the calendar. I think you can go backwards and look at everything that we did last August during the Vegan Challenge, but the Vegan Challenge is a month-long challenge encouraging omnivores to commit to a plant-based diet and to explore veganism for 1 month. And I try to be very clear about distinguishing between a plant-based diet and veganism, although I think it's lost on some people. I'm doing my best to get that across. So, and we host a variety of events during the month, dinners, potlucks, movie nights, all kinds of things. And I would say that we've averaged probably 50 participants each year. So, and basically, I'm clear about telling people what they're committing to. When you sign up for the Vegan Challenge, you're committing to follow a plant-based diet for one full month. That means no meat, no eggs, no dairy. And then you have the chance to explore what it means to be vegan and what a vegan lifestyle entails. Of course, you know, and really just leaving it open, people do what they will with it. Some people seem to really get it, and it sinks in, and they're vegan for, you know, it seems like they're going to be vegan for life. And other people, you know, it's not their time, and they celebrate by eating a block of cheese at the end of the month. So it's very interesting. But so, gosh, I'm not even sure, and trying to keep this brief where to start. What I'm going to do is, if people are interested in participating in a learning group of new organizers to create a vegan challenge in your area, I want to set that up this year and help basically create this group and mentor people through how to start it, you know, and through their first year of a challenge. So if anybody's interested in that, they should email me at veganchallengedayton@gmail.com, and I'll also put that up on the message boards in the forum. I'll give that information there. And basically, it's just what I really try to do is, and with the help of other vegans, create a whole month that is, it's fun, it's easy, it's supportive, it's educational, and ultimately want to create an environment where people see that this kind of lifestyle is really sustainable. Because it can be hard, depending where you live. It can be really hard to be vegan. And I've run into a lot of people who have tried to do it in a bubble, you know, all by themselves. And typically, it doesn't last for them. So it's really about, you know, being encouraging and supportive and making it fun and easy and creating a community, which has been amazing to see little groups that still get together for potlucks and, you know, various things. And people have joined the Dayton Vegan Meetup group. And so it's really something that over the last 3 years has been gaining a lot of momentum. And restaurants that I have never even been to, I've never even talked to them, you know, they're telling people who go in who are vegan, they're like, who's doing the vegan challenge? We want to be a part of it. Because part of what we do is we partner with businesses in the community who, you know, specifically either are vegan or cater to the needs of vegans. So it's like an incentive for people taking the challenge. A lot of restaurants will give, you know, maybe 10 or 15% off during the month. We have health food stores participate, you know, different things like that. So,
brilliant.
I'm gonna stop talking for a second and see if anybody has any questions. I know it's late, so I'm just trying to, like, go through this really quickly.
Right. Well, you've given some great ideas. You've given a good overview and website. And, like, I think it's a great idea if you can post something maybe to the forums, you know, some more information, or at least a website, and then the idea of having a group maybe later this year. Maybe you could mentor people who would like to do a vegan challenge in their city. I think it's great. If anyone has a comment or question, just press star 2 or type it in for Persephone. But you're right, Persephone, it's getting kind of late. It's been quite a long call already. And it's been wonderful. It's just kind of flown by here. But I'm just looking to see if anyone has any questions. Looks like, I think that's, you gave great information. Is there anything else you want to just close with, or you feel like that's good right now?
I think that's good. I think people can go to the website and read what it's about. And if anyone's interested, I mean, it is something that it's a little bit of an ambitious undertaking, and you know, I
right.
came to it with a background of, you know, I had started my own business and I've been involved in event coordinating and stuff. So especially if you've never done any of that kind of stuff before, it can seem really daunting. But, you know, now I've been through this three times and I feel like I feel like it's something that could be done, that anybody, if you really want to make this happen, you could do it on any kind of scale you want, even if you say, you know, I'm going to do this, and my goal is to have 10 people in my city do this, you know, and just keep it small the first year. Like, it's just, it, you know, I feel like I can work with people to make it very doable no matter where you are, you know, and what your skills are. So.
Great. Okay, so that's fantastic. Thanks so much for giving us the so much good information to load on that. That's wonderful.
You're very welcome.
All right. Thank you so much. Let's see. We've got just a few minutes left here. Trying to see. Is there anyone else? I know Mark is on the line, and we haven't heard anything. Mark, would you like to... just give us a few words of wisdom from Cincinnati or whatever's going on with World Peace Yoga, World Peace Jubilee, and the work that you're doing to help spread the message of the World Peace Diet. You're one of the real banner wavers of the movement here, and I'm so glad you've been with us the whole call. So, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Will. And glad to be here, of course, and it was great to hear from Keith. That was very inspiring.
Right. Yeah, he is definitely in a class by himself, really. He's a poor guy. I mean, if you read this book, he's been really beaten up by the police numerous times, and he just keeps coming back with serving free vegan food. And it's an amazing story of love, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to see how we might partner with him and his organization. Love to have him speak at the Jubilee this year. Looking forward to that happening. And I can say that things are moving along in Healdsburg, California. So we're very enthusiastic about that. Looking forward to the grand opening of the World Peace Diet Center and World Peace Yoga Studio April 13th, 14th, and 15th. And we know that Julia Butterfly is going to be speaking, and Dr. Michael Clapper is going to be speaking. So
great.
And the vegan restaurant in the former Cafe Gratitude, the soon-to-be World Peace Jubilee restaurant, that is moving along. So it's great to see that the vegan movement is growing.
Right. Great. Well, it's growing because of the efforts of people like you, Mark, and I think everyone on this call. As we keep bringing the message to the world, people are responding. It's just a fantastic time to be alive, I think, right now. It's so challenging in so many levels, but there's a lot of wonderful news happening, and this is some right here. The actual ability, like what Persephone's doing with creating the vegan challenges, what Mark's doing, creating a conference and centers and that are spreading the vegan message, and Tara has been teaching about veganism at Whole Foods, and there's been, I know all of you are involved in multiple projects to help, whether it's just talking to neighbors and friends or helping your local church or whatever it is. So it's really great. Oh, yeah, also, Mark, is there... anything else? It's getting kind of late, so I just wanted to, if you don't have anything pressing, I'd love to here, if there is anything else you want to share with everybody, but if not, there's one more person I want to get to here. So.
The only other thing I'd say lastly is that I'm looking forward to collaborating with Persephone. She's just up in Dayton, which is just north of Cincinnati. So I can imagine that we could have a powerful vegan collaboration. So looking forward to that happening.
Great. Yeah, that's a fantastic idea. Persephone, what you guys are right in the same metropolitan area. So, wow, that's fantastic. All right, good. Thank you. So we'll look forward to being in touch, Mark. Thanks so much for being on the call.
Sure thing. Thank you, Will.
Yeah, all right. Talk to you later. And then actually, our good friend, one of the real leaders of the vegan movement in this country, Judy Carman, is also on the call. Judy, hi there.
Hi, Will.
Thanks so much for being with us. Judy,
this has been a great
author. Yeah, it's been great, hasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it has. It really, it makes you feel like, okay, this is really happening. We're really getting the vegan message out there.
Right.
So many great people doing this. Well, I won't take up anybody's time. I'm sure everybody's getting tired, whoever's left, but I wanted, Will was nice enough to let me come on and mention where we've really heated up this campaign to get two elephants out of the Topeka Zoo. And our website is elephantfreedom.com. And we have a petition there and how to help section where you can write letters or emails to the city council and the mayor and the zoo director. And I just got home from a meeting with the zoo director tonight, and he let me feed some lettuce to the giraffe, but I did not see the elephants. They're indoors. It's very, very cold. It's about 10 degrees out right now. And they're inside. When it's this cold, they're inside on concrete the whole time, and they're in a very small enclosure when they can go outside. So we have billboards up. We've got articles in the paper. People are pretty excited about it. And although the zoo director is not caving in to what we want to do, which is to send these two elephants to the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee, he's seeing that there's a tremendous amount of public pressure going on right now. So if any of you out there, you dear ones, would like to help Tembo and Cinda out, they need your prayers and they need your letters and emails. So thank you, Will, for letting me say that. We need all the help we can get.
Right,
really,
you're so welcome.
A lot of noise.
What's the website again?
It's elephantfreedom.com.
Elephantfreedom. I'm just writing it down. .com. Yeah. I really recommend that. And you can go there and help. And Judy is a longtime vegan activist and author of some great books: The Missing Piece, Chicken Soup for the Vegan, Veggie Soup for the Chicken Soul.
Thank you.
And, Peace to All Beings, the fellow lantern author. And we've also co-founded the Prayer Circle for Animals, Circle of Compassion Ministry. Please check that out. It's www.circleofcompassion.org. We've got a lot of new things happening, and we have lots of new things happening there. Tara's helping us out, and we have the prayers for the day, and we have our daily prayer circle for animals. So if you would like to be involved with that, please go there. Right. I think it's just great to see all these things happening. All right, Judy, thanks again so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah, well, thank you, Will, for letting me tell everybody. Thanks,
right,
everybody,
great.
For your help.
Great, thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. So I'd like to just thank everyone for being on the call tonight. And I want to draw your attention to the January 2012 resources for the World Peace Diet Circle, which you should have there on the site. And there's a lot of information, really. It's a lot of information there. I spent the whole month collecting it, but it's kind of good to go through some of these things. A lot of good news, actually, about the fact that there are fewer animals being killed in the United States every year. This is coming out, and the numerous health benefits that are being continuing to be emphasized in the mainstream media. There's links to a lot of my articles that have come out over the last month that I've written, or radio interviews or videos that I've done. And a variety of very interesting things that are happening in the world of spreading the vegan message. And so please check all that out, everyone. And I guess the final thing I'll say here, since it is really time for us to bid adieu, is just remember that this path that we're on is a path of ultimate triumph, in the sense that ultimately we will be successful. And so even though it may seem at times that it's just a very small or such a tiny minority, we are a minority that has got a vision, a positive vision, and we have the flow of the universe, the unfoldment of greater interconnectivity and compassion and understanding. And so as we just continue to be perseverant, I think that's the key, is to just continue every day to do what we can. And I think it's perseverance is by far the most important quality in this whole thing, more than native talent or anything else, just simply continuing on and supporting ourselves and supporting each other. And I really want to recommend that everyone have some kind of a spiritual practice, connect with nature, connect with the inner silence, connect with the spiritually inspiring readings, and do what we can to create community that will support us. Madeline and I will be continuing to travel in our rolling home throughout 2012. We're going to many different parts of the country, so send us an email if you're interested in having us come to your part of the world. We'll see if we can do that, put on a talk or something like that. And in the meantime, we have our next call will be in February, the first Tuesday, February 7th. And so please join us for that. And in the meantime, after that, I just want to wish everyone just a beautiful couple of weeks. Until then, stay in touch. Don't forget we have the forums where we can talk about the issues, ask questions or respond to comments or talk about successes that we've had. All these things are really helpful. So I think that's it. On behalf of Steve Prusak and myself, just stay in touch. Email him if you have any technical problems. Email me if you have any other questions. And let's together make it a beautiful life. Continue to spread the message of compassion for all life. And Madeline and I send you all our love. Bless you all, and thanks again for joining us tonight.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Moderator ID accepted.